This is Eric Rutan of Cannibal Corpse. You are listening to the Scars and Guitars podcast with Andrew McKay Smith.
G'day, everybody, and welcome to the show. I'm so pleased you can join me for a chat with Sponge frontman Vinny Dombrowski. Now, the catalyst for our introduction is due to a new album of sorts. It's called Planet Girls, and I say of sorts because it was recorded back in 1999, but it's only seen light of day in 2024, and you'll hear all about why throughout the chat. Elsewhere, well, this chat is one of those ones that's been on the horizon for a long time. Rotting Pinata and Wax Ecstatic, the albums from 1994 and 1996, respectively, had a tremendous impact on forming my listening taste way back in the day. So it's another reason why Vinny was on my bucket list. He's a tremendous fella. I really enjoyed talking to him. And in hindsight, there's probably a lot more questions I could ask him, but I didn't want to take up any more of his time than what I did. Maybe there'll be a round two sometime in the near future. But either way, this is a good one with Vinny Dombrowski from Sponge.
How are you, Andrew?
Yeah, good, mate. Thanks very much for taking the time to do this, by the way. I must say it's been an opportunity has been long looked forward to.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been on the road lately from what I hear.
Yeah, we typically go out to the West Coast. It seems like and do a West Coast tour once a year. And yeah, we just got off of that not too long ago. And did a gig outside of Cleveland and Lakewood, Ohio last week. So we're just ramping up for this thing we're doing in July, really, with a package tour with Power Man 5000 and Tantric. So we're back in town for a minute.
Do you find that the band's legacy, it's enduring for old fans like me, but do you find that you're picking up new fans?
Oddly enough, yeah. I think we're becoming one of these, it's like we're after 30 years, you know, people refer to you as a legend or legendary rock band, these kinds of things. And when you start throwing around words like that, I think younger people go, huh, legends. But also I think that there's been a real serious interest with younger people in the 90s music, whether it's any of the grunge bands or post-grunge bands. I don't know what it is with younger people, but they really seem to gravitate towards it.
I had a chat with Dean DeLeo a couple of years ago, and his publicist gave me a stern warning before the chat, whilst I was on Zoom, funnily enough, not to refer to them as an alternative or a grunge band. What are your thoughts on that? Are you happy to accept the mantle and be called either alternative or grunge?
Well, I really do think that to say that back in the day we were rock bands would have done a disservice to many of us. And nothing against Chuck Berry or the Rolling Stones or the Beach Boys, but I just go, I mean, at the time that we were all kind of emerging, there was certainly the predecessors of the grunge thing, the West Coast hair metal or the metal bands. They had their day. And what differentiated everybody was this particular label of grunge or post-grunge or alternative, which created massive, you know, an adjustment in radio and sensibilities and fashion and how bands presented themselves. So, you know, to sit there and go, well, don't refer to me as an alternative artist, but it really, that's what changed everything for all of us. So I have no issue with being called alternative or post-grunge or grunge. It would be nice to say, well, I'm just a rock and roller, but that's not what quite differentiated all of us from back in the day.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, the catalyst or the opportunity to have a conversation with you comes about through, it's now, correct me if I'm wrong, I understand it's not a re-release. Planet Girls is actually, it's effectively a new album, but it also has a companion album that was released in 1999. So it's a bit of a rediscovered chapter in Sponge's history either way. So what prompted its release?
It really, the idea didn't even exist until we were sitting talking with Jason Heartless, who plays drums with Ted Nugent, who was filling in as a drummer for Sponge. And with the many different trips we had on the road, the idea came up of whatever happened to those recordings from the first, the first recordings from the third album. So essentially the third album that everybody knows is New Pop Sunday. We recorded many of those songs prior to that release, and Jason was like, well, whatever happened to those recordings? And so what we have today are those sessions that were the predecessor of those songs that are what people know that are on New Pop Sunday.
It's hard to compare the two, even though they're based on the same songs. Planet Girls, to be quite frank with you, is I understand, okay, it's a superior sounding album, but I also understand it's the album that you wanted to release back in the day, but there was management or label constraints around that. So can you talk to that?
Yeah, I mean, it was real simple. We went and recorded that third record. We were on Columbia, the same label that released our second record, Wax Ecstatic, and we delivered the record. And, you know, just to be clear about Sponge, you know, we were very heavily involved in the production of the first two records. And we did have an A&R person that was with us during the first and second record, Pablo Matheson. But we were always very involved. And so the idea of taking the band and switching out A&R, and then our production ideas were kind of put back seat, was very different to us. So we delivered that record and the label didn't like it. And we were just like, well, this is weird for us. And, you know, we really didn't dig the record as much as we thought we would either. So at that point, you know, Columbia's like, well, you know, you guys can work with outside writers or you can take the record someplace else. So we decided to take the record someplace else.
It's relationship to the two big ones, if I can call them that, so Rotting Piñata and Wax Ecstatic, it's far closer than what, say, New Pop Sunday is. So was the labels thinking at the time, hey, Goo Goo Dolls are similar to you guys, alternative and certainly appealing in some way to a metal and punk crowd. Hey, why don't you start releasing stuff that sounds like Iris?
You know, that's an interesting analogy, because we all know what the Goo Goo Dolls were. Were they a metal blade like back in the day? Like this, and I thought they were fantastic then, and I do now. But I think that the band was leaning in a more pop sensibility, especially working with John Kalodner, you know. And so we're like, wow, this is John Kalodner. He's worked with AC/DC, he's worked with Journey, you know, he's that kind of guy. So I guess we need to make that kind of record. And not really understanding that at that time there was a major shift in what was going on at radio, rock radio, alternative radio at the time, which was really putting us real heavy bands, you know. So it was a shift to pop music in a time where pop music was like, you know, might have worked for the Goo Goo Dolls, but it was not going to work for Sponge.
What about Tim Padelan? I understand he's been in the fold now for 30 years or thereabouts in some way, either as a producer or as a band member. And he's listed as the producer on Wikipedia at the very least. I mean, you've only got the sources that you've got, right? So well, New Pop Sunday. So was he also under any duress as well, do you know?
When we sat down to make the New Pop Sunday album, Tim was super involved. Like, we were like, you know, we're just getting back to what we know. We took everything that we could take from Columbia, those reels, and we either recut, remixed, added new songs to make New Pop Sunday. So Tim was at the helm, you know, really. So under duress, we were all I suppose under some kind of pressure to release something that we thought would work. So I don't know, maybe he's always under duress.
Maybe I could have picked a different word, but it's one of those things where, you know, corporations like to have what I call hallway conversations with people, like do this or else, that type of thing. And given you guys are clearly good mates, I thought he might have sort of let you in on some secrets or something at some point.
I wish he did, man. We always went out to that studio and did exactly what we wanted to do. We recorded the first two records at the Loft. So yeah. Now, just going back to the loft back in the day, it was like, okay, we're taking charge again. So we rolled the dice with that.
The other thing, though, too, right, we talk about Tim, and he's one thing, but Kevin Shirley is something completely different. Now, he actually produced New Pop Sunday, was listed as the producer anyway, and that sound is a huge departure for him, as far as I can see. He did the Silverchair album, and he after you guys, he went into the studio with Iron Maiden.
Sure. So
in the middle of all that, he produces this lush-sounding pop kind of an album, which is a huge departure for you, but not just for you, for him. So I wonder why he got involved and made it sound that way.
Well, I mean, Kevin Shirley is really more of an influence on the Planet Girl record. He was certainly an influence on and part of some of the tracks on the New Pop Sunday record, but it was taking some of the tracks that we cut with Kevin, and then it's almost like taking a brick house and putting aluminum siding on it or something. You know what I mean? It's like we took the main ingredients and we moved it away, recut vocals, recut guitars and a lot of things. So there are some things that Kevin, like I think like Planet Girls, a song on the New Pop Sunday record, is untouched. That's like all Kevin Shirley, you know? Mm-hmm. But I know Kevin is credited on the New Pop Sunday record without a doubt. But the Planet Girl record, that's primarily Kevin Shirley. I mean, that's with the exception of maybe Planet Girls from the demo that is on the Planet Girl record, if that makes any sense. The Planet Girl song was from a studio in Detroit called Roscoe's Recording back in the day. So that is really the song that is not credited to Kevin Shirley on the Planet Girl record, but most of the other stuff truly is, yeah.
Yeah, that makes way more sense now. I probably had it round the wrong way. But, now you say that Planet Girls is really a Kevin Shirley artifact. Wow, I can hear that. And
yeah, yep.
From the Silverchair album, you can hear similarities, yeah.
Oh, there you go, because whether it's like Thousand Times, My Lackluster Love, Let's Get Together Now, those songs we cut with Kevin. So Kevin was in the producer chair. You know, he mixed those songs, and that's all Kevin.
Do you still in touch with him?
Not at all. I haven't seen him since we had a little rap party at the studio with Kevin and John Kaladner and the band. And after that, I haven't seen him, man. I mean, it was funny. I think he came to Detroit for some pre-production one time. And, we were in a restaurant, and one of my funny memories of Kevin was, he was just a kick-ass dude, didn't give a rat's ass about what anybody thought. He's sitting in this foo-foo restaurant that we felt we had to take everybody out to dinner, and Kevin's sitting there smoking a cigar, and there's people, going, you got to put that cigar out. And he's like, fuck you, I'm not putting the cigar out. You know what I mean? He really didn't care. So he just smoking, enjoying his cigar with the band. Didn't bum us out, but it bummed a lot of people out.
Good story. Yeah, nice one. Yeah. Now, I mentioned up top, I'll out myself as an old fan, probably as old as you can get in Australia. And I know we weren't your biggest territory either, by the way, because we'd go to concerts back in the day and talk to people and say, one of my favorite bands is Sponge, and they'd say, who? That type of thing. But I'll open with that. It might have changed now, but do you have a relationship with fans in Australia?
You know, we just didn't get over there to play. I think that's half the battle. Like our buddy Art from Everclear was just over in Australia doing an acoustic tour with Brendan from Wheatus, right? So Wheatus had that big tune, Teenage Dirtbag, which was a big song in Australia. Am I correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So I put it together. I'm going, why is Art touring with Brendan? And I go, they got to have the song. So yes, we just had that big tune. So we never got over there to play. I think had we gotten over there to play, we really would have made an impact with the crowds and perhaps whatever radio there was to have to promote a record over there at that time.
Yeah, you're right about that. In Australia, just with the influence of pub rock here through the 70s and 80s, you had to come out and play. And it's not about earning an audience. It's just about coming out and building a relationship with fans in that way. And I really wish it did happen for you, because you probably would have had a unique market in the way that Art does. I know Everclear is still huge here, and off the back of one song, I just saw Wheatus play at the Pandemonium Festival, and you wouldn't know any of their other songs, to be quite honest with you, but they've got that huge song and you see the entire crowd, so 5,000 people singing along to it. And
oh, my God.
Yeah,
it just blows my mind. I mean, I go, what is that band, a punk rock band with the Mullis, Emil and the Sniffers or something?
Yeah.
Are you hip to them?
Oh, I know who they are. My mates booked them before, so I was familiar with them through that, yeah.
Yeah, man. It's just like, that's one of the more, there's a newer groups that I've seen come out, but it's just like, I think we would have done great over there had we gotten there, but it's just getting over there and the label going, there's a market for it. It's all that label shit. You know what I mean? It's, are they going to put up the money for the band to get over there? And fortunately, like right now we got an agent that books like overseas and we haven't been to Europe. We haven't been to Australia. We haven't been to Europe in many, many years, but we have never been to Australia or Japan. And I just wonder, might there be a market for it at some point? I would like to think so.
Hmm. Nina Menasha was the first song that I heard. I think it's similar for a lot of people because it was a lead radio single back in the day from Rotting Pinata. But it's peak alternative 90s, and it had a huge impact on my listening habits. I sung the song's praises to anybody who cared to listen back in the day and even now, frankly. But look, it is a song that I measure almost all alternative hard rock against if I'm looking at it from a critical analysis perspective. So there you go. But from your perspective, was there anything special about that song you felt when you were writing it?
Well, I mean, you know, we can talk about the recording of it. And I think that the recording of that song was just effortless. And it really was what Sponge was and what Sponge was to become. It was just effortless. And, you know, we didn't take a lot of time recording songs, you know, but with Joey and Mike, with the guitar approach that they had, and, you know, let's face it. There are really no alternative bands with that double guitar thing. I mean, there might be two guitar players, but the parts were never as well thought out, I think, in any bands.
Yeah, great.
With the exception of Sponge, you know, like lots of bands like Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, the Scorpions, they would do those wonderful harmony guitar parts, very well thought out guitar parts. I think we were the only alternative rock band that really had those parts put together. So those guys would sit with those guitars and those parts to make those huge layers that would really support that vocal that's there. And it was pretty fucking effortless, you know, like that. There was not a lot of thinking going on in that song. The guy sat down with the parts and made sure they had them right, but man, they just crushed it, you know. They crushed it, and I think it supported the vocals so well.
You're right about Joey and Mike, and I'm sorry to hear about Mike as well. I did do a tribute on the show for him, but just focusing on Mike, what were some of his gifts? You've talked about some of them there, but can you talk a bit more about him as a guitarist?
He always had these really strong ideas, fantastic rhythm player, just a good sense of what, like Mike was the guy that come up with the intro in Plowed. You know, Mike came up with the guitar part in Have You Seen Mary? Live Here Without You. I mean, there's all kinds of things. The guys, like Mike and Joey, were the perfect guys to work with each other because they had the same sensibility about writing. They would come up with these great riffs that would be effortless for me to come up with lyrics and melody to those guitar riffs because they were so strong. And that doesn't grow on trees. That doesn't happen with every guitar player. You know, there's great guitar players. They can play rhythm. They can play great lead. But coming up with those kind of guitar parts that really make people remember and make a writer like myself want to write stuff to them, that's pretty rare. And there was no shortage of those parts.
Hmm. Yeah. Are you still working with Joey?
No. Joey left the band in about 2003.
Uh-huh.
And she went to go work with he went to go play bass with the Detroit Cobras, you know, because like that, the grunge, the garage thing was, you know, pretty happening in Detroit back then. And I think Joe just wanted to make a big life change. So one of the greatest guitar players on the planet went to go play bass with the band. And I'm like, well, okay, if that's what Joe wants to do.
Those stories are way too common, unfortunately, reacting to record label and media interests and the like. Thank God we've moved beyond that these days, and it's just internet culture, and really it's given bands a second and third wind, and it's got to be credited in that way. But for you, how challenging was that period post year 2000?
Oh, I mean, it was just almost a nightmare. When you think about the bands that were kind of folding up, like all those bands, whether it was the Smashing Pumpkins, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, that was a weird period around 99, 2000, 2001. It just seemed like everybody was closing up shop. And a lot of folks wondered whatever happened to us. They were like, well, I know about the first two records, maybe the third record, but what did you guys close up shop as well? But we kept on cranking out records and playing gigs, you know, all the way through. With 2003, I think we put out For All the Drugs in the World, you know, and that's the last record that Joe worked on. And we just kept on cranking out records and playing gigs. Because, you know, and I got to say, with the type of band we are, we still get into the van. You know, we don't mind getting into the van and driving and playing the gigs, because that's what we do. We were on Lollapalooza with the Melvins on the second stage with the Cows, the Melvins, and Sponge in 1996. And one thing stuck with me that Buds from the Melvins said, and he said, Ben, if I can go out there and make one record a year and tour on that record once a year, I'm making a living. And I go, man, that's pretty cool. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, and other people have ideas about what it is to be in a band or being a rock star. But when Buzz said that, I go, man, that's pretty cool. I think I'll do that too. So I go, if it's good enough for Buzz, it's good enough for me.
What about the dynamic shifts in the band when you bring in new members and other members come out? I understand you've got a very strong core at the moment based on what I can see the lineup is. But it takes a while to get there, doesn't it? So did you find that aspect of it challenging as well?
Well, you know, the band was super solid, but 2003 all the way up to about, it was like 2021. And Billy, our drummer, who had been with us for, I guess, probably 20 years at that point, decided to call it quits. So, you know, Billy was no longer with us. And we had Jason Heartless playing drums with us for a minute. But, you know, he's new as this drummer. So we finally got Dave Coughlin, who has been a Detroit drummer for many years, played with Taproot and other various groups. But he's been with the band a couple of years, and he just sounds fantastic. So the band is finally once again gelled. I think the band sounds better than it ever has. And it's great to go out and play live with that confidence. And we're recording some new music too. So for the band to go and record with this lineup too is pretty special.
Have you had many offers to play Rotting Piñata and or Wax Ecstatic in full?
You mean like in its entirety?
Yeah, it's a big thing at the moment with albums being played from start to finish.
Yeah, you know, when Rotting Piñata turned 25, we did do that. And the thing about it is, like, the album is an interesting album to listen to, you know, when you're at home, maybe from start to finish, you're driving. But as far as like playing the album in its entirety at a venue, it doesn't make for real strong showbiz, you know? So we did a ton of that music, man. But there were some songs that kind of fell by the wayside a little bit. Like we would play Candy Corn. I'm trying to think what we wouldn't play or what didn't seem to go over well. People, you know, they want to hear things, but maybe not in the order of the record. Wax Ecstatic was the same way, you know? But now we're on the 30th anniversary of Rotting Piñata. So we're playing a lot of the Rotting stuff. You know, we want to release a record too, the 30th anniversary record, which, you know, we could talk about that as well.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, so that's, what are we at now? 2024, so Yeah, it's hard. I mean, all this stuff sounds like yesterday. I'm sure it's the same for you too. But Wax Ecstatic is 28 years of age at the moment. So have you got the start of the negotiations for the pressing plants and the vinyl facilities to get some vinyl pressed up for Wax Ecstatic's 30th birthday?
Oh my God! Well, yeah, we've been fortunate though. War God is kind of gone, and they've quarterbacked the re-release of vinyl for Riding Pinata, which somebody might be able to find some of this stuff out there. And then War God did the Wax Ecstatic release as well. So in the last couple of years, we've been able to get that vinyl, sell it at shows. And people love to get the vinyl at the shows, man. They're just like, oh my God, you guys got this vinyl. And War God just knocked it out of the park, man. They just crushed it. So
apparently we can blame Taylor Swift and Adele for this surge in vinyl popularity. Can you believe it?
I don't know, man. It's like vinyl has been just crushing. Like, you know, being from Detroit, so it's like, I know Jack White is very passionate about vinyl. He's been like flying that flag. We got Archer pressing here in Detroit that I've gone to do vinyl, but it seems like vinyl in the last 20 years still seems to be kind of important. And if Adele and Taylor Swift helps that whole campaign, God bless them.
You mentioned Detroit a couple of times. Look, from the outsider's perspective, it's got a reputation as a municipality that can't pay its bills. So parts of the city are deteriorating just based on the images you can see on YouTube from those urban explorers that go in there. But the transverse side of it is that it's had this enormous cultural impact through rock and roll and through music. So what's your Detroit?
My Detroit was the complete lawless place that we could do whatever we wanted to do. And it's an interesting question you bring up, because the NFL draft was just here in Detroit, and the governor was on the radio talking about, you know, we need to be proud of Detroit and say great things about Detroit. And I was trying to think what is it that I would say. You know, some people go, well, it's been gentrified and things have gotten better. But truly what I always thought that was so unique about the city of Detroit back in the 80s and the 90s for me, well, the 70s as well, you know, the post-67 riot and all this stuff, because you had that massive exodus of people leaving Detroit and going to the suburbs, which left open all of that space, which used to be homes, but they became rentals. Then they became things that people burned, you know, and this kind of stuff. Because 1996, we were on the road, but Devil's Night was a real big thing in Detroit. And I don't, did you guys grow up having Devil's Night before Halloween?
We didn't even have Halloween until recently. It's an internet thing that even my kids celebrate now. So I knew what Halloween was, but it was a strictly American thing that we used to look on in a bit of awe upon.
Well, right on. So before the night before Halloween, we all got the license to go out and, like, you know, deface property and automobiles and other set stuff on fire. But in 1996, we were on the road and we saw the national news, like Detroit burning, you know, like literally so many house fires and all this kind of shit. So, you know, Detroit was just basically... Somebody asked me this also one time when they came to Detroit. They were from Europe. They go, when was Detroit bombed during the war?
Yeah.
I like Detroit was never bombed during World War II, but that's why I think like people like Bowie and Iggy would go, well, Detroit reminds us of Berlin. But to get back to the question about, you know, Detroit, what makes it unique, Detroit was a great place to do whatever you wanted to do. And music, having... The kind of clubs that you could do whatever you want and live however you want, and nobody would bother you or question you about that. And also, yes, it's a dangerous place. And I think out of that kind of desperation and danger and need, if you're an artist or you're a musician, there's interesting things come up out of your work. And I can't help but think that if it wasn't for Detroit, I don't think there would be me. So if Detroit was unique in any sense of the word, the uniqueness stemmed from that environment in those years at that time.
The band definitely had a harder edge than just about all of the others in the so-called alternative scene. It was almost metallic at times, like Nina Mishak. It's Nina Natasha, it just came right across. And that's what drew me in. There was the Alice in Chains thing was one thing, but when I heard Nina Natasha, I was like, oh, as a bloke who listens to Morbid Angel, all of a sudden I've got this angle into alternative angle, alternative music. So there you go.
Oh, and it's great to hear. And I love Alice in Chains, man. You know, I just think it's a wonderful band, and to see that people are still loving that music, it's fantastic. Mm. But yeah, Detroit back then, it was the perfect landscape, and we had absolutely nothing to lose. And when you have nothing to lose, you can do anything you want, and you got everything to gain. And back in Detroit in those days, you know, living on nothing, living around nothing, it was a perfect opportunity to make that music.
Mm, yeah, great point. What about for you when you look, if career is the right way to describe it, when you look back over your career, what gives you the greatest sense of accomplishment or well-being?
The fact that, you know, people can say what they want about Sponge's music. They look at Sponge as a band or the legacy of the music. But at the end of the day, I always felt that we were always doing what we wanted to do, you know. And for that fact, I was always proud of that. I look back at Rod and Pinon, it seems to me like it was an art project or something. It wasn't like, you know, we're not sitting there writing hits. We never thought Plowed was like a hit like we heard on the radio. You know what I mean? Back when we were listening to the radio in 1992 and 93, sure, alternative music was starting to blossom slightly, but rock radio was still full of Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, Foghat, you know, Jay Giles. I dig a lot of those bands, man, but, you know, Plowed didn't sound like that.
Yeah, I've got to play bloody Jay Giles every weekend. I play covers, so I've got to put, what's that bloody, I know all these songs just by how I play them, not what their names are. I can't remember the big hit, you know, the nah, that bloody song. your music and compared to theirs, mate, I know what I'd take any time, any day, but yeah, it's an interesting, radio, it doesn't really, does it, that's a question for you, does radio exist in the States?
It does, but it's just full of legacy music. And so Sponge could release a record. Is there room on rock radio anymore for a new Sponge song? Sure, they still play, you know, Plowed, they play Molly, they'll play Wax Ecstatic or Have You Seen Mary, just like they'll play The Rooster by Alice in Chains, or they'll play, you know, Damn That River. But, you know, do they play Mount Rainier Fog by Alice in Chains as much as they play The Rooster? The answer is no. So it's like that's what we all run up against. They may play some new Sponge for a second, but what they want to play is the legacy stuff, you know. And alternative radio, the way we knew it, it's all kind of morphed into rock radio, and that's it. So does it play new shit? They might, but they just want to play all the old shit. So does it really exist anymore? Rock radio doesn't exist in the sense like it used to, where it used to be local. It used to support local shows. It used to have a presence at local shows. They used to interview us for shows. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with you. When I ask you if radio exists, of course I'm aware it exists, but in here it's more or less morphed into just talkback and bullshit radio. And the internet versions of it. So Triple J was I'm trying to think of what it might have been equivalent to in the States. But the point is, it was a bit like it was an alternative station back. It had been around since the 80s, but really came of age throughout the 90s. And so, of course, you've got a lot of people that are around about my age or thereabouts, and they just seem like as though they're too fat to get off their bloody couches or out of their cars or something like that, because you listen to the playlists that are curated for them on this thing called Double J. Okay. And you feel like as though you're just listening to the greatest hits of 1993 or 1994 or something, and, you know, long lost gems from back then. I make a specific point with my show, with my music show, of playing just new music. Okay. Great. So I do the interviews for Legacy and for all of the people that I love talking to, but the music show is wholly and solely dedicated to new music, because if you don't foster new music, especially by the legacy artists, what have you got to look back on them for? Just the one or two songs I had back in the day. And that was one of the reasons when I got the email about what was going on with you guys with Planet Girls. I thought, wow, this is as good an opportunity as I'm ever going to get to talk about And it's unique in this way. It's new old music in some ways for you, but I play your music on the show, and the new music, I mean, and I just that mentality, it's I understand it, but I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to look back in 20 years time on 2024 and say this was the retro vibe of 2024, so we're going to hit that, and it's all about 1994 all over again. So yeah, I don't know what these internet tastemakers and curators and these radio programmers actually think is going to happen, but their advertising model's bullshit. And as far as we're, you can't actually, the listener numbers can't be credible, surely. I don't know how they can get accurate numbers for them, because that's how they get the advertising in as well. A bit like newspapers or what have you. It's all antiquated music forms. It's, if your shit trends on TikTok, you can do an entire tour of a continent these days. That's where we're at.
You know, I mean, you know, provided it really translates, I think that's half the battle. You know, somebody could be, you know, banging on TikTok, YouTube, that kind of stuff, but does it translate into tickets? And it, like for us these days, man, the only thing that I got to really promote the band, it would be our band doing buys for the shows that we're doing, making ads and doing buys, and pushing it on Facebook and Instagram, man. I mean, and whatever other thing we can think of doing. But, you know, fortunately, these days, it seems like we're gaining traction again for some reason. And it might be because are we a nostalgia act? I don't know. I really don't know. But we're picking up the newer fans, and we'll bring in the fans from 1994 to the shows. It's an interesting time for us. And even the guys in the band are going, huh, there's something going on. And I go, well, yeah, there could be a lot of things going on.
Yeah, I mean, just despite what I said, you know, about the retro aspect of everything else, but the point is, you guys never went away. You've always been there. You've always been there or thereabouts releasing music. And from Rotting Pinata up to right now is pretty much a solid line. Okay, yep. So, and that's the point. You've got all of this material. So whenever anybody, if you tour Australia and we go and see you at the Tivoli or wherever it might be, You've got this enormous catalog from which to draw material from. And if you're able to be nimble enough and actually just go, hey guys, the crowd is vibing on the heavier stuff, let's go there. And you've got, say, a song from, say, 10 years ago that you can rip out. You're going to make brand new fans that way.
Sure, man. Absolutely. And fortunately, the band can and does pivot on the fly, man. You know, it's like we started making set lists again. We stopped doing set lists for many years, but we got set lists, you know, so we got the songs we know we're hoping to play, but somebody may suggest something from the audience. They may suggest Nina Menasha, and we go kick ass. Cause you know, 2 years ago we were playing Nina Menasha. We haven't played it, you know, recently, unless somebody suggests it, and they do. Or they might suggest the deep cut B side, Cowboy Eyes. For some reason, people want to hear Cowboy Eyes. They're like, okay, we'll play that, man. So it's just like the band is just so, like, I guess, ready for anything. We can do that kind of shit.
Do you have, when you go to different markets, I think Spotify, they do it geographically. I don't know whether they do it hyper geographically in terms of city by city, so say Chicago versus Detroit, but looking at your popular songs on Spotify, Play Out If You Can Believe, it's at 24 and a half million streams. So are you able to go into some of that data and see which songs are big in certain areas and then tailor your set list that way?
Wow. I would have to really do some research on that one, Andrew. I mean, I'd have to go in and, just dig through the minutia of information. Hmm. But, you know, it might make more sense for us if we were traveling out of the States to really tailor our set list to that. You know, I had never thought of the angle, but it's a great idea, something to think about.
Yeah, I heard back in the day, you never know whether these things are true because I haven't spoken to a member of the band, but Rod Smallwood and Iron Maiden, when the Napster thing, but even beyond that, when the BitTorrenting thing started happening, they started approaching some of the owners of these BitTorrent sites and saying, look, you're doing it, whatever. People are taking our music and they're not paying for it. Okay, whatever. But what we really want to know is what they're downloading. You give us that information and that's enough. And they were using that, I think, to curate set lists for different different territories, and you can find Maiden these days. I think they sold out in 3 or 4 hours here, and that tour went on sale about 18 months ahead of the date, and it sold out in 3 hours. So there's something in it. That's all.
Yeah, it makes sense. Again, I think that going out to going out to play Europe or coming to Australia or something like that, it would make a lot of sense for us to kind of tailor it like that. It's funny. I think we know here in the States what radio is playing. You know, they're playing the hit tunes, you know. There may be an independent station, a college station. You know, if there is an alternative station these days that does specialty radio, they might be playing some of the B-side stuff, which I go, that's cool. But I think it's typically Wacky Ecstatic, Roddy Piñata, or I'm sorry, Wacky Ecstatic, Plowed, Molly, and maybe Mary and Nina Menasha.
Yeah. Mate, it's been a fantastic chat. I really appreciate it. As I said up top, it's been a long look forward to, and I really enjoyed it. I can only hope, mate, that some enterprising promoter out there in Australia I'm talking about reaches out to you and asks how about it, because we'd love to. You do have fans down here, man. You've got people that are quite passionate, as you can tell, about the group down here. So I hope to see you soon.
You know, I'll put the bug in my agent's ear, because I think that just letting my agent know that they're – could be some interest. They just they'll start beating the bushes, so to speak, and we'll try to figure it out. But I'd love to come out there, Andrew, and I appreciate the conversation. I've learned something from it, so thank you.
No, my pleasure, mate. Well thanks very much. Thanks for the music, and hopefully see you down here soon then.
Thank you for your time. Take it easy.
Well, there you have it, a chat with Vinny Dombrowski from Sponge. Now, when I mentioned in the introduction there were some other topics I probably could have addressed with Vinny, I'm thinking of The Lucid, the band that he formed with ex-Megadeth bassist David Ellefson. However, I did talk about The Lucid with David and Vinny. I talked about Vinny as well. So if you're curious as to what David has to say, go across and check out that episode. But otherwise, what a fantastic fella. Great to finally meet him. So there you go. That's it for now. My name's Andrew Mackay-Smith, and I'm the host of the Scars and Guitars podcast. Until the next one, it's a very goodbye for now.